Oak Room Meetings, Buddhist Summer School, 1973, Thursday, 30th August, 1973.
I see there is a question for me here. I trust the questioner is here. In what sense do you use the term ambivalence? I use it in the usual meaning of the term, the duality, the oscillation by ourselves between the two duals within the sphere which are encompassed within the sphere of duality. We all know how the psychologists talk of the love, hate, cruelty, kindness, ambivalence, they call it, oscillating between the two. Just in that sense, our virtue-vice conflict is a conflict within the orbit of ambivalence. The state of duality. That is all. Let me say a few words first in connection with how karma works. Every single stimulus, every energy word, action registers its impress upon the psyche. In the psyche, it is a living energy, therefore. And every living energy works itself out. There are literally millions of these living energies within the psyche, interacting with each other, working themselves out. And this working out, the nature of this working out, is of a complexity which completely defies any detailed analysis or description. Our heritage, our physical heritage, our psychological heritage, what our socio-cultural conditioning does for us, all that registers its impress upon the psyche. The beliefs of our people, their practices, their customs, all of these are forces within the psyche. The moralities, the rituals, the process of daily life, everything is an energy in one's own psyche. And I mention the psyche particularly because it is essentially through the medium of the psyche that these things, these energies, take effect and release the pattern of our whole life. This word karma is a tremendous thing. We have no conception of what it is like. We may disagree with what has been handed down to us by our fathers, by our society, our culture, and so forth. We may rebel against it and say, this is wrong, this is evil. Indeed, it may be wrong and evil. But the strange thing is that there are all forces within ourselves which unconsciously we have accepted. It is part of our being. Never forget that. Whether the morality of our society is right or wrong makes no difference whatsoever to the fact that that particular kind of energy residing in our psyche operates in our lives. I don't believe in love, honor, and obey. I refuse to have the word obey. Outwardly, consciously, that may be the case. Whether it is right or wrong to obey makes no difference to the fact that this particular kind of energy is transmitted to us from the time we are born and is part and parcel of our psyche and the very flesh and blood and bones of our being. You see, this is what makes karma something of universal dimensions. When we go against, as we call it, what is the custom, good or bad, of our people, our race, our society, we think, and by no means unjustifiably think, that we are doing good. Yes, we are. But remember, we are going against the stream of our own free will and accord. And in that going against, we are in conflict with the psychical forces in the midst of which we live. And therefore, pain, difficulty, sorrow, ostracism, all these things come to us because we are, again, not unjustifiably doing good. Do we understand then how and why the good doer suffers, is miserable? You see, in one sense, we live under the dominion of the prince of this world. And he's a little bit of a devil, sometimes a big bit of a devil. And he has power and authority over us. And whenever we try to serve the Supreme Lord, who never imposes his will as the prince of this world does, then we are up against a titanic force. So now we must understand that whatsoever there is in our total environment and within our total being inevitably exercises its influence upon our lives and releases the pattern of our particular life process. This brings in a very important point. This question of vicariousness. we rebel against vicariousness, not in Christendom particularly, is also rebelling strongly against the whole idea of vicariousness. And vicariousness is simply a fact. We participate in the good effects of anybody's good deed, good thought, good action, good word, etc. We also participate in the unhappy consequences of anybody's and everybody's evil thought, action, etc. We can't avoid it. Supposing there's a factory over there belching smoke, horrible oxides of sulfur and nitrogen poisoning the atmosphere and all the rest of it. Very well. We have to take in the air that we breathe. The whole air gets infected through the diffusion of gases. We have to take it in. We cannot escape it. If an epidemic breaks out, one infected person comes from Timbuktu or wherever he comes from into Britain, spreads a disease, we all get it. At least, I mean, you know, thousands may get it. Thousands may die. Suffer agonies. There is this curious element of vicariousness, isn't there? You see, we do not live unto ourselves or for ourselves. We are inextricably interwoven, parts and parcels of each other. When you see this as the operation which comes under the name karma, you see that what can well up from within us is nothing but compassion, with that understanding. The two invariably and inevitably go together. Insight, perception, wisdom, loving kindness, compassion, forbearance, patience. You see? But we must understand that karma operates deeply. It's the totality of forces, whatsoever they are, irrespective of our petty little concept of I'm doing good, therefore I must get happiness as my reward. Not at all. It is precisely this vicariousness which enables us to understand one profound aspect, at least, of the significance of a universal totality, which is a great unity. Do not forget this. That is why to restrict the word karma to any idea of adjustment is a mistake. Can't do it. Our concepts of adjustment are the shopkeeping concepts. Here are the goods, they are worth precisely that much, you pay that much money and you take the goods. It's not like that. When one can see it, when one can be compassionate, then one can remain poised. And in that state of poise, you become the center through which there emanate those forces which bring about purification, growth, and fulfillment in the true sense. That is why in ancient India, for example, to take one example, the great teachers taught this teaching of karma. Creative action, fundamentally, which in itself is acausal, which is utterly free, which in its working out in our state of consciousness, which is the ambivalent state still, because it hasn't come to fruition yet, brings about the conflict of the dualities, difficulty, misery, sorrow, and all the rest. I hope that will help you to understand something about it, and understand also, therefore, the extraordinary responsibility each and every one of us bears. The way I receive every impulse and influence that comes to me, and that is my heritage, to which I cannot say no, it is there, you see. The way I receive it, and then the way I let it work itself out, purify it to the fullest ability that I have, and then make the response which comes out of understanding and compassion. And that is how there takes place the resolution into harmony of the totality of the karmic forces that work through oneself. Allow a minute or two to pass by, and let the mind quietly sort of absorb it. See it operative in your own lives. as you see it clearly and feel it very sensitively, intensely, you will find that the silent tears in the heart at the sorrow that besets our lives will purify the psyche. Those tears are not to be repressed. They will flow within the being and wash out the ache of the heart. You know how the Buddha said that the true friend is one who, amongst so many other things, will even lay down his life for you. Words which were echoed by Jesus 5 or 6 centuries later. And this power to lay down your life means the power to endure and suffer through compassion and understanding for the sake of the other one. See also how it affects the course of action. One does not run away from the painful situation, from the evil situation. One does not just walk out and shirk one's, or give up one's responsibilities which were once accepted. Because once accepted, it is the power in the psyche which will work and work until it is fully worked out. And if in terms of action I run away from it, it will pursue me wheresoever I go, into whatsoever situation I deliberately enter, thinking it will be a better situation for me. All this necessitates the release and the growth of a sense of unity, of an intense sense of unity, of complete relationship with all the world. Let us then utilize a few minutes in a form of meditation which a good many of you may remember we did on a past occasion. Here we all are in this room at this moment, engaged in meditation, in an activity of communion. You can hear the sound of that airplane. You can feel that the air is somewhat cooler than it was yesterday. And you know that the time is more or less what it is now, say 2:30 in the afternoon. All along the half of the longitude which is our longitude, from the North Pole to the South Pole, on this side of the globe. It's 2:30 in the afternoon. And at this time, people will be doing the usual things that they do at 2:30 in the afternoon. Supposing we were to move eastwards in imagination, we will come to the longitudes where the time is actually tea time, and all creatures and all, or rather all people living in those longitudes will be carrying out the actions which are carried out at tea time. And so on, you can go right round the globe. And you will find, therefore, that at this single earth instant, this single instant out of the 24 hours of the earth's life, our 24 hours are fully acted out. People are sleeping, people are waking up, and so on and so on. Going to work, going back home from work, according to the longitude in which they are. Now just try and sense this very intensely. That in this single earth instant, mankind is doing all that individual men and women do in the course of a day. And add to that the nature of the actions. Here there is war and explosion and murder and horror. There is construction and kindness and beauty and all the rest of it. There are 3 births taking place every 2 seconds. And so many deaths taking place also. Birth and death. So many birthdays being celebrated. There is so much sorrowing and enjoying. so much good and evil, all taking place in thought and feeling, in speech and action, this very moment, all over the globe. Everything happens simultaneously in terms of the life of the earth. Try and sense this very intensely and strongly. Let the psyche absorb it within itself and remain poised. That's very important. Now, if I am truly sensitive and poised, I will not react against anything. I will not react in favor of anything. But I will absorb everything into myself in a transcendent manner, which takes me out of the domination of the sphere of ambivalence, oscillating between two opposites. Look at this very sensitively. And you will find that fear and horror, that emotional disturbance in the pleasurable sense and ecstasy, none of those will shake you. And in that state of harmony, you realize the nature, the quality of that unity of all mankind, which is the fact. Extend it to all the events that take place, to all the kingdoms of nature. There is storm somewhere, calm somewhere, cold somewhere, drought and heat somewhere, and so on. Include it all, include. Try and touch in this sensitive state the pulse of life itself, the universal life that creates constantly, sustains and nurtures and transforms. The pulse of life of the whole of Mother Earth. And when one really senses it, and sees it clearly with the mind, one learns that one must never be an interferer with the life process. Deluded by the egoistic idea that I am going to alter it for the better. It's an extraordinary conceit and an evil conceit. The sort of conceit that brought about the statement that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We must cease to interfere with life, with the process as it goes on. Now, sensitive to it, understanding to it, with the outwelling of compassion and wisdom, one responds at the right moment, in the right place, quite spontaneously and naturally, with the right action. And that's all there is to it. There must be no planning out by thought, by our imperfect intellects, of schemes and ways and methods to change the world for the better. It is a wise humility which knows that oneself is impotent. Power belongs to the Lord. The darkness of death can be seen, can be understood, and the face of death changes from one of terror and cruelty and destruction to a face which is benign, which is infinitely pitying the sorrow of man. And so the face of death becomes transfigured into the beauty of life. Taking the whole of life on this globe, the soil, the interior of the earth, the trees, the oceans, the animals and birds and man. It's not too difficult to do this kind of meditation by yourselves at home. And you will find an extraordinary power and peace the power which comes to us even as we are because of the non-imposition of ourselves upon our environment. Which means that all egoism is out. And if you have the time and the inclination and the ability, feel this sensitivity, including not only the earth, but all that there is in our whole solar system, all the energies that flow, that act, and with which we are interwoven, of which we remain unconscious to the day of our death. If you can do this in the right spirit, perfectly poised, and with real humility, in which quite naturally there is no self-conceit whatsoever, you will understand something of the powers that underlie some of the ancient ritual practices which the few in those days knew by virtue of their esoteric knowledge. But don't meddle with such things. Just let the mind in quietness and peace be sensitive to it. And then they will purify the psyche itself. This kind of purification of the psyche is a great burning. It is a burning without consuming the material which burns. One of the meanings of the burning bush, out of which the voice of the Lord spoke to Moses, just come to here and now gradually. Emerging out of your own mind some significant idea, some seminal idea or thought, which is a message from the depths of your own consciousness, innermost consciousness, which comes up to the surface as a light to guide, or nothing may happen, one or the other. perhaps all of you, or at least some of you, will see now why the Buddha, time and again, after a discourse or other, said to the bhikkhus, "Do not give yourselves cause for remorse. Here are trees. Sit and meditate. Sit and be in communion." Let us now try something else, which is intimately related to all this. You know how the Buddha constantly reiterated not grasping. Not grasping first and foremost at the pleasures of the senses. In other words, to become totally free of self-indulgence in any and every form. Totally free of self-indulgence. This does not at all mean the repressing of the sense functions, but it does mean the complete freedom from deliberate grasping at the pleasures of the senses, which are intimately tied up also with the pleasures of the mind. You know how often we say, "Oh, let us go here. It is such a beautiful wood. There are such lovely trees." And one goes and feasts one's eyes upon them and derives sensational delight. Of our own volition, we seek the pleasure. And the Buddha says unequivocally, absolutely unequivocally, he says, "I say that this way there is only bondage, there is only dukkha." On the other hand, the Buddha taught us to train the senses to be fully observant, to be fully sensitive. And now, note the difference. In the course of everyday life, that which is a source of delight, of joy, of beauty comes before us. We don't seek it. We don't grasp it. It is there. We are here at this for these few days. We have been already a few days, and some of you will be here a few more days. And there is marvelous peace and beauty around. These trees and the quietness and so forth. Let that peace and quietness and beauty soak into the psyche. It is the divine gift through Mother Nature to us, of which we are integral part and parcel. Let it soak in. If there is the absence of grasping, there is the freedom from greed. The because wheresoever there is greed, there is hankering after the objects of the world, then inevitably there is dejection and inward conflict and misery. But this way there is no dejection. When the scene changes of its own accord, you are sensitive to it. It may change into a situation where the sensations record discomfort, pain. Yes. Be mindful. Be balanced and poised. Absorb the pain. Understand it. Don't grasp it. Don't try to throw it out. Do the sensible thing, of course. If the body falls ill, of course, call the doctor and take medicine. But be fully observant of the pain whilst it lasts, because it will do something very wonderful. It will make your sensitivity for the world pain greater and greater, and it will draw out compassion and understanding. There will be no element of blame or condemnation of anybody or anything for his wrongdoing which brought pain. Because that way you bring redemption unto mankind. So you see, not the pleasures of the senses, the freedom from grasping at them. You are a musician, you are a painter, a sculptor. You have skills, you have abilities, you are a scientist, you are a philosopher. Now, will you indulge your intellectual and aesthetic greed and passion by grasping at art and beauty and philosophy and all the rest of it? I did it for 40, 50 years. That's why I'm talking like this. And I know the futility and vanity and the bondage and the sorrow of it. No, don't grasp it. You have the God-given gift of a Mozart or a Beethoven or a Shakespeare or Michelangelo or whatever it is. All right. Use it for the glory of God as a gift from God through you to the totality, God's own body, and beautify it. It's a sacrifice, a making sacred. And the stupidity and the absurdity of the element of loss and gain is completely out. You are free. This is being balanced in Nibbana. That state where there is no greed, no hate, no delusion. So you see, the pleasures of the senses involves all that. And the Buddha, one can expand this for hours, there's so much to it. And the Buddha always says, look at everything with the full awareness that it is passing. What has come to be is passing away. As it comes to be, live it, let it pass away. Don't hold it back. Don't hold the stream of life in. Let it go to its nirodha, to its fading away. And in its fading away, and allowing it to fade away of its own self, enables you to be enlightened. It's a curious thing, enlightenment. The enlightened one is totally free from grasping. totally free from any and every reaction which is in the category of greed or hate or delusion. That is the enlightened one. Not the one who has a wonderful idea or a belief. All ideas, all beliefs, the Buddha said, let them go. They are put-togethers, they are sankhars, and they are evanescent, ephemeral. Let them go. They will come, they will emerge out of your own being, according to the state of development of your own intellect, your own intelligence, which is a constantly creative thing. It will throw up ideas and thoughts. Don't grab the ideas and thoughts. Let them go. They may help others, of course, who are at a stage where this particular idea or thought is an inspiration, an enlightenment, or whatever it is. But oneself, never hold on to the thought and say, I have got the truth. I can never hold the truth in my fist. It's not something which can be held. So now, this letting the thing come to its natural ending. And if you let it come to its natural ending, you will understand quite clearly the meaning of this process of transformation, of this great process of transmutation itself, which is part of the extraordinary creative pulsation which I call life of a life. Now you can experience this, you can realize this. Now we'll try. Once again, just let the body be perfectly free of all strain. That's important. Let it be completely at ease, so that no part of the body obtrudes upon your sensitivity and your awareness. Let the rhythm of the breath be gentle and quiet. And just as the earth, despite its tremendous movement every day, it moves something like 1,700,000 miles through space every day. 1,700,000 miles. Despite its tremendous movement, appears to us, feels to us perfectly still. Let the body be still. This is very important. It's the stillness that does it. If the body does remain perfectly still, you will find that all that appertains to body, to action and reaction, will just fade away by itself. You can also practice this under one very favorable circumstance in another posture, namely when you are getting up in the morning, just lie perfectly still. You will find some quite remarkable things happening. Pertains to matter, to the concrete, goes to its nirodha, its fading away. Feel that the whole body is perfectly light, not a burden. Completely at rest and at peace. And if you can hold it like that when you do it by yourself for even about 5 minutes, preferably a little longer, you will actually experience this subtle, intangible, transmutative activity going on. And there'll be no desire at all to grasp at any actions, at any objects, to bring about this, that or the other physical results and so forth. And then during the day, because of the freedom from desire, all actions will be that much more constructive and sensible. Now, as with the body, let there be complete stillness of the feelings. Here we are, we have a more difficult task. Don't strive hard about it, just be sensitive to your own feelings as they arise in the immediate now. And generally speaking, first thing in the morning when you wake up, they will tend to be calm. Now, when the feelings are being observed, just watch the course which they take by themselves, because the course they take will reveal to yourself just exactly what you are at the moment. Do it very calmly, very peacefully, not trying to direct the stream. Just watch it. And as with the body, you will find that the feelings will come to their ending, to their nirodha. And so too with the thoughts and the thought process. We can't do it now together as a group. This is something which has to be done by oneself. But when the body, the feelings, and the thoughts are perfectly still and they have been allowed to come to their nirodha, their ending, you will find that the reality of the deep jhanas is actually present. It won't be there in terms of an idea or a thought or a picture. Remember the words of the Buddha in this connection. With the going down of all sensory perceptions and so forth. You'll read it in your discourses, wheresoever the Buddha talks of these things, and he does so very often. And in that state, you realize a new dimension of being and consciousness. What is the special value of this for you and for the environment around you? For you, it means purification, the state of utter purity. The mind becomes empty. It becomes void of all that clutters it. Namely, the particular thoughts, feelings, beliefs, ideas, convictions, conclusions, and so on. This means that your mind at last is healthy. It is in the state of maturity. And pure intelligence can then function freely. And you see the proof of things. You are in the state which the Buddha talked of when he referred to himself as one who is not liable to delusion. Those are some of the things that happen to you. Mind you, until the full realization of that perfection of purity and equanimity and mindfulness, this will come and go. But here is a way in which you can make it real in actual practice. And for your environment, what happens in this state? Now remember, these states, the deep jhanas and samapattis, are not trance states. They are not trances. You are not entranced. I know that some very great scholars have used the word trance. For my part, I say quite categorically that that is a mistake. Nor is that other word, the raptures or ecstasies, as used by Rhys Davids in the old days and by some modern people too. They are not raptures, they are not ecstasies. An ecstasy is a being beside oneself, a standing out of. Nothing of that sort happens. If you want to use the stasis idea, it is, if anything, an enstasis. That is, a complete and perfect self-containment. It's an entering within. Look within, thou art Buddha. You don't merely look within, you enter within the sanctum, the adaitam. Now it is important to realize this, because this is the state of poise, the equanimity, the upekkha, which is so very important. Now, in this state of enstasis, with one's own mind utterly transparent, purified, fully awake, you are the focus point into which enter transcendent energies and go out affecting your whole psyche and your entire psychical environment. You know how in the mythologies of the which accompany the religious teachings, the philosophical and metaphysical religious teachings of the world, in the mythologies, they always talk of this war between the demons and the angels. Now, the angelic forces is a convenient symbolical term to represent what happens in reality psychologically. In this state, these transcendent energies purify, bring to perfection, bless, the whole psychical atmosphere. This sort of thing is partially reflected in that statement in one of the Majjhima Suttas, where it is said that when the question is asked, what is it that the disciple does, which enables the whole of this wood, this woodland in which they were assembled, all the great disciples were there, Ananda, Sariputta, Moggallana, Kacchana, and so many others. And they all make their little contribution. The question is, what is it that he does that enables this woodland to be lighted up by a great light? That is the symbolical form of talking of things like this, which are realities of the psychical life and the mental development of him who treads the path. Now, if you practice this quietly by yourself, you will understand one of the real reasons why the Buddha so often mentions these jhanas and samapatis throughout his discourses. And don't be misled by what anybody says, that they are merely trances or sort of deep states of consciousness. You enter into them and you get out of them, and there is not much in them related to true enlightenment. Enter the states, realize, and then you will see for yourself. The Buddha would not have emphasized them so much unless they were of great value. Just a few moments. Every second which goes past brings nearer the time of what we commonly call ending, but which in reality is the time of fruition. The ceasing to be of this is coterminous with the coming to be of that. You know, when a great composer writes a symphony, we tend to say that it comes to its climax and then the last great chord. The last great chord is not the climax of the work. It is not an ending. It is not the death of creation. The last chord of the symphony holds within itself the totality of what went before, in which there were several climaxes all the way through, and it holds the promise of the entire future in it, the last chord of that symphony. This is the marvel of creation. and it is best reflected in art. Never regard the last chord of the symphony, oh, it's finished. Not at all. This is the promise of the future. And the future is of the nature of eternity, of totality. Just as much as the now is of that same nature. And the so-called past was of that same nature. He who sees it as an ending, as a death, is caught within the sphere of ambivalence. And therefore the sphere of regrets, of sorrow, and so on. The Buddha called himself the good friend. The good friend was one who, amongst other things, gave the meditation subject suitable for the disciple. The Buddha was the teacher. He declared of himself that he was. 25 centuries ago, all that happened. Today, the times are different. They are new. And through the great rhythms of history, you always find that there come those periods when the times are in decay. And when the times are in decay, someone or a group of people come along who sound the new note and pour out the new life. And in our times, the old order in certain aspects cannot come into being. Wheresoever it does, you merely get a sect formed, another divisive factor in an already sadly divided and warring world. The times now have no place for the teacher on the pedestal and the disciple down below relationship. We are all learners. We learn together. The social conscience and the social consciousness of the world is now coming to full adulthood. And unfortunately, because of the troublesome adolescence-ness of mankind, it is coming to it through war and struggle and misery. But it is people like you and I who can naturally be the living examples of the right way, the human way, the happy way for the emergence of this social unity, this social reality. You will appreciate, therefore, why I never regard myself as a teacher at all. And please do not regard me as a teacher. I am your servant, if you like. That is all. And to me, it is a privilege. It is a real honor to be allowed to serve. It is something which to me is supreme happiness. I can't understand what I have done to deserve such happiness at all. And I don't want to know the reasons. It has happened so. This is the grace of life, which functions through your graciousness and kindness, which I do appreciate. That is why I care for you. You are all dear to me in a very real sense, a totally unsentimental sense. If you wish to go to hell, well, you must go. Find out. I shall always be there if you like to come back. The doors are... My house has no doors or windows. It's that open. rather drafty. But there it is. You see? I am not an Arahant, and certainly not a Sama Sambuddha. So please, don't try to put me up on a pedestal. My balancing powers are weakening very much with age. But let me then wish you every joy in your living of the holy life. Remember those words of welcome of the Buddha. They ring, they sound through the world now, this day. Come, Bhikkhu, live the holy life for the complete ending of all ill. And I've tried in my little way to suggest a few helpful ways in which that may be realized. Thank you.